Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorick. In a pair of major decisions today, the last day of the term, the justices of the Supreme Court upheld Arizona's voting restriction and say that California cannot require nonprofits to disclose their donors. In the Arizona case, the six conservative justices found that two laws relating to collecting and counting provisional absentee ballots, did not violate the Federal Voting Rights Act. Many legal observers, including NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg, say that in doing so, the court has basically made the landmark 1965 civil rights law a dead letter. The court also struck down a California law requiring nonprofits to file a list of their large donors within the state, arguing that by identifying large donors, it limits their free speech protections by exposing them to potential harassment. Here to talk about all of it and what the implications are for us here in New England is Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be on.
And also with us is Michael Curry, head of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Michael, thanks for being here as well.
Glad to be here.
All right, Judge Gertner, I want to start with you, and let's start with the voting rights case. I think it's important to get some context here. So let's take a step back. We know that in 2013, the court had already weakened the Voting Rights Act with the Shelby County decision. Can you remind us what that was all about and what that did effectively?
So the voting rights statute was a way of dealing with what had been endemic in the South, in particular, efforts to undermine the voting of African American in our elections. And, you know, it started in, you know, in the post-Reconstruction era with literacy tests and poll taxes, which, though neutral on their face, were implemented both with the intent and the effect of eliminating or undermining African American votes. The Voting Rights Act, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, required that in certain states that had that kind of a history, there had to be preclearance, which means that before you change the voting requirements or the polling places, et cetera, it had to be cleared by the Department of Justice. In the Shelby County situation, the court essentially ended that in an extraordinary decision that said, I'm just paraphrasing now, discrimination is over. That was then, this is now, we don't need this preclearance anymore because the world has changed. Literally within days of the Shelby County decision, their efforts in across the South, principally Texas, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, to restrict voting. I'm getting this from Justice Kagan's dissent in today's decision, which is, you know, that it took it really moments after the Shelby County decision, suddenly there were efforts to restrict voting. The net effect of which was to restrict voting for African Americans across the South. All that was left of the statute was Section 2, and that meant that you could claim after a law was passed, you could say, hey, that law discriminated against African Americans. You couldn't do it before it was implemented, which is what Section 5 required, but you could do it after the election. And that's what happened here. In Arizona, there was a challenge under Section 2 to the rules which had been implemented in the November election. Namely, if you voted in the wrong district, your vote can be thrown out. No one else could bring your votes to the polling place except yourself and election officials. The latter had the impact, particularly bad impact on Native Americans who lived, you know, miles and miles and miles from a mailbox even. And the former had an impact on the African American community who were frequently moving from place to place, transient. And therefore it was not there. The numbers of African Americans who were accidentally appearing at the wrong polling place were higher than for whites. So the notion was that these two requirements, the polling place issue, the vote harvesting, it was called, provisions were challenged under Section 2. And the six-justice majority said they are facially neutral and they're intended to protect against fraud, even though no fraud was shown.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But so from that, what does this mean for what's left of the Voting Rights Act? You can't challenge before. Does this mean you can't challenge after, or what does it mean realistically?
Well, it means that you can challenge afterwards. People can continue to challenge. They didn't invalidate Section 2, but the standards are mushy. The standards are mushy. Essentially, the arguable fraud, that's all that was involved in Arizona, is a sufficiently important state interest to justify burdening the right to vote. Arguable fraud, not proof of fraud, but arguable fraud. So the standards that were laid out by the majority are enough to decimate Section 2. I agree with Nina Totenberg on that.
All right, Michael, bring this home for us. Why does this matter to folks here in Massachusetts, and how is this decision resonating with you today?
Yeah, so I think most importantly, the judge laid it out perfectly. I think the best that I've heard in the last few hours in trying to process this decision. I would remind people, when we talk about Reconstruction and we talk about which I judged sarcastically referred to as the Obama years, where post-slavery, people thought we had made so much progress and that now there's opportunity. And out of that was born the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment. But we know that there's always a backlash to progress, that there's a backlash to people accessing this right to vote and participating in the franchise. So as we sit here right now, end of July, 17 states had enacted 28 new laws that restricted access to the vote. So this is not about 19th century efforts to curtail the right of vote to vote for African Americans. This is about the 21st century effort. And unfortunately, that's born in large part by one party, by the Republican Party, and in particularly in the South. It's not new. It's why we needed Section 5 and why the decision in 2013 was a gut punch to many of us who have been fighting and for generations for voting rights. And this decision today by this court in a 6-3 decision is an additional gut punch. But, you know, I would remind you and all of your listeners when I say elections have consequences. This is what happens when you don't show up to vote. Decisions are made about judicial appointments, not only on the Supreme Court level, but on the federal judgeship level throughout the country. And they result in decisions that are adverse to the interests of people who care about democracy. And I think the dissent in this case really highlighted that, as Justice Kagan said, in a single statute, if a single statute represents the best of America, it is the Voting Rights Act. It carries two great ideals, democracy and racial equality. I think her words resonate in this moment.
Yeah, I'm struck by something in the majority opinion, which states the inconvenience of voting for some isn't the same as having unequal access to voting. What do you make of that argument, Michael?
I'm sorry, repeat that again.
The inconvenience of voting for some isn't the same as unequal access to voting.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's always the case, right? Whether it's counting jelly beans, you know, whatever the system that's been employed, you know, grandfather laws, you know, all the systems and tactics that have been put in place. I always use this, and I've said this on your program before. This is chess, not checkers. And chess is how do you control the demographics of the voting population in a way that benefits your party or your interests? That has always been the case, as the judge pointed out, since Reconstruction and even prior to Reconstruction.
Yeah, Judge
Gertner.
That
is the case today. That's the case today.
Yeah, Judge Gertner, just going off of what Michael just said, I believe that it was even said during oral arguments, those who are defending the Arizona law, that if it was allowed to be struck down, it would disadvantage them politically. What did you make of hearing that in arguments and how that plays into the decision here?
Well, that's extraordinary. But the decision doesn't, of course, mention that. I mean, the Section 2 could not be broader. Talks about, you know, the abridgment of the right. Doesn't talk about the elimination of it. Talks about resulting in the denial. Doesn't have to be intentional. They don't have to do it purposely, even though you probably could show that this was purposeful. You couldn't have a broader statute than this. And I think this is a shot across the bow by that group of six, that these cases are essentially, you know, they're not going to get involved in election stuff. They weren't going to get into gerrymandering, political gerrymandering. There was some basis for that in constitutional law because that's oftentimes difficult to figure out. But they're also not going to get into racially burdensome voting restrictions. I mean, the key here is there was no fraud that therefore necessitated this change.
But to that point, I want to read a little bit of Justice Alito's opinion. Quote, rules that are supported by strong state interests are less likely to violate Section 2. Fraud can affect the outcome of a close election, and fraudulent votes dilute the right of citizens to cast ballots that carry appropriate weight, end quote. Do you think states should be allowed to enact laws that deal with potential fraud, protecting integrity of elections?
Well, yes, but the potential fraud can't be a ruse. In other words, potential fraud here, there are other ways of monitoring, you know, whether or not someone going to, you know, harvesting the votes, as I'm using their language, actually using Republican language, would amount to fraud. The concern about fraud could open the door to, you know, unless you have an embossed seal on your voting, on your vote, we won't count it. That's, I mean, that is a requirement that has no end to it. And the most you can say is when that interest, you know, results in burdening African-American right to vote, it should give us pause. Let me just say something, even though I'm jumping ahead here. Think for a moment here. So this was a voting rights statute, arguably because of arguable fraud. It resulted in burdening, to whatever degree, African-American and Native votes. In the other case that the Supreme Court decided, which allowed, in which donors' identities were to be disclosed when they gave to nonprofits as part of the state's regulatory framework, there the court says, hey, there's a First Amendment interest here, and there isn't enough showing of fraud to justify producing the donors' names.
Interesting. Pause when you put them together like that.
That's right. You put them together. Fraud, you know, arguable fraud is enough to undermine the vote, but arguable fraud is not enough to require the disclosure of donor names.
All right, so we'll get to a little more on the donor decision in just a moment, but I want to stick with the voting rights one for just a couple more minutes. I can tell you're both pretty fired up about the decision. Are either of you surprised by it?
No, I'm not surprised. I think, you know, this is, again, elections have consequences. We knew, and I think there's some legitimate record that Chief Justice Roberts was targeted on this for a while now, that the addition of Justice Barrett is the direction we were heading in. And now that you have a 6-3 conservative court, it's not just about voting rights. It's about abortion rights, it's about guns, it's about affirmative action. It's all on the table now. So, again, no surprise, but it's the price we pay for not showing up at the polls and not making sure that we have a president who values democracy and can make sure that these things that are so critical are protected.
Judge Gertner, what about you? Is this a surprise or more kind of the next logical step after the Shelby County decision?
I wasn't surprised after the account of the oral argument before the court. What you've seen this term are the judges trying to, you know, show that they are not, you know, in one camp or the other. So there have been a number of 8-1 decisions and even 9-0 decisions, and numbers of commentators are saying, hey, that suggests that this is a court that is, you know, careful, deliberative, neutral, et cetera.
Right.
Actually, I think it's a court, at least some members of the majority, that are just holding their fire.
Totally
in some cases, reserving it for others, and this is obviously one.
So I do want to talk. Yeah, sorry, go ahead, Mike.
Just the ACA decision recently was an example of that, right?
That's so, right.
You know, we took a breath to know that they voted the way that they should have voted on the ACA. But I also said to friends in the legal community, let's not get too comfortable because other decisions are coming in. Here we see this decision today.
Yeah, the ACA, obviously the Affordable Care Act. I think that was a 7-2 decision. I want to talk about what this means because, Michael, you mentioned southern states specifically, but voting rights legislation has been kind of popping up, or I should say restrictions have been popping up kind of across the country. 48 states have something, more than 20 new laws restricting voting have been acted this year. My home state of New Hampshire has been talking about bills that would make it harder for college students who live in the state to vote. How could this SCOTUS decision affect states that are trying to proceed with those types of laws?
Well, I think it's momentum, right? And when any of us who've been in this work for a long time, and I have both on the national level as I chair the National NAACP's Advocacy and Policy Committee, and on the state level, I was involved in redistricting a decade ago with the state legislature and even in Boston. It's momentum. And right now, the pendulum has swung, both based on the 6-3 court. There are victories that if you're conservative, you want to curtail the right to vote and curtail other rights, then you're feeling a victory in this moment. And quite frankly, you're going to see some other victories coming. I don't care if you're in New Hampshire or Des Moines, Iowa, or Seattle, Washington, or Montgomery, Alabama, and you care about democracy and justice. This should concern you, because this is about all of us and these issues. This is just the beginning. And there's some momentum that the conservatives who are trying to curtail those rights have at this moment.
All right, Judge Gertner, let's shift gears and talk about that donor decision that you mentioned earlier. Explain what this case was all about and how the court found today for us.
So California, like every other state, regulates not-for-profits. In exchange for that regulation, you then get tax advantages and other advantages, et cetera. And because there are so many not-for-profits in California, the state required that one of the things you file when you file your regular reports with the state was a list of your donors over a certain amount of money, those who gave over a certain amount of money, and you had to disclose it. And that was part of their regulatory aim. Presumably they would, you know, monitor who was giving to what to see whether, I'm not sure what the regulatory purposes were, to see whether they were, you know, following the rules. But in any event, they wanted donor lists for those purposes. They were largely confidential. There had been instances in which there had been information that had been released, but they were supposed to be confidential, and the state represented that they would be confidential. An organization backed by the Koch brothers challenged the disclosure of the donor lists, and the court says, and stay with me on this, because there is no need for the donor production of that list because there's no showing of fraud. No need for it because there's no showing of fraud. And what hangs in the balance is the First Amendment. You really have to step back and say, there's no showing of fraud, and therefore you don't need to stop donor lists, and the First Amendment is important. But when there's no showing of fraud, voter restrictions are just fine. I just keep on going back. Makes it easier to give money than it is to vote.
Well, and this is an offshoot of Citizens United, basically, right? They're calling money a version of free speech.
Well, that's right. Yes, it comes from that, and it actually puts on the chopping block potentially the requirements that, you know, one of the things that lasted after Citizens United was that you still had to disclose the names of donors in a political campaign. And the question is whether this decision would provide a rationale to even undo those restrictions. But you really have to, you know, apparently the right to give money to nonprofits ranks above the right to vote.
Michael, you've got experience with nonprofits. What did you make of this decision?
Yeah, I mean, you know, two of the key parts of how we ensure some accountability in our system is, you know, I think of it as the scale. And one side is accountability and the other side is transparency. And you want both to be balanced. And the scale is broken. In the case of voting rights, the accountability piece has been removed. In the case of this other decision, the transparency is removed. We need to know if there's undue influence in our process. We need to know if there's fraud in the process. We need to know who is investing where, for what purposes. And I think as a functional democracy, that just makes sense. And in fact, I would argue that many Republicans would look for that transparency in other places. And the contradiction is they don't want it in this case. So contradictions abound. I use the term once, politocrats. Hypocrites and politicians. This is another decision similar to Citizens United that reverberates, and we as activists, civil rights activists and others will have to really mobilize, because we'll be working and fighting against this for years to come.
Judge Gertner, I was really struck by something in this decision that basically the reasoning seemed to be if you were exposed as a donor to some of these groups, you'd face potential harassment. And that they wanted to protect folks from that. Is that something the First Amendment protects us from? Is that, how does that, what's the legal leap there that's being made?
Well, there's a body of law that talks about associational privacy. And actually, it started with an NAACP case. It starts with, my lists, my membership list should be confidential because I have a right to associate with whom I want, and there's a chance that if I associate, that my association would be undermined if you found out that I was a member of the NAACP or the ACLU or something like that. So that's not an illegitimate concern, but when it's applied to donors apparently giving supposedly confidential information to the regulatory authorities of California, that's a different issue. That's not the giving it to the globe. That's giving it, it's giving it to a regulatory authority. Now, as I said, there had been instances in which information was leaked, but the question then is whether you undo the regime rather than tighten up the leaks.
All right, a final question for both of you, because Judge Gertner, you said something at the beginning of the interview about this court basically being partisan but picking their spots, to paraphrase what you said. And I'm just thinking back. We've talked before on this show about the importance of faith in institutions like the Supreme Court. And that feels to me like a pretty cynical approach, if that's actually what's happening. What do you make of that, and how important is it for us to have faith in the Supreme Court as an institution?
Well, I think it's important for us to have faith in the Supreme Court as an institution. And certainly there have been there are indications that the six, quote, conservative judges actually have meaningfully different views on, for example, criminal justice issues. Gorsuch and Kavanaugh have split on mostly on criminal justice issues. And that reflects sort of real jurisprudential differences between them. But in addition, during this year, there have been a number of times that a major precedent has been upended. And you have a dissent from, it's usually Kagan, but it could be Sotomayor, that says, why are you overturning this precedent? What is coming down the block here? When can we wait for the next shoe to drop? And it's clear that these are dissents that are forecasting Roe v. Wade and are forecasting affirmative action. If you dilute 30 years of precedent in Area A, there's a risk that it's diluted just as a principle in other areas. And so I'm looking at the dissents and looking at the discussion about something as bedrock, as precedent. And that's what I think this year represents, a number of skirmishes in a larger war.
Michael, briefly, last word goes to you.
Yeah, I'm a historian about this stuff as well as an attorney, but I defer to the judge and her deep knowledge. But I always think of the bookends for us is in the study, which is Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal. We didn't have faith in the system at that time. It was not faithful to equal rights and social justice. And then it came back decades later with Brown v. Board. Separate is inherently unequal. So there is ebbs and flows to this legal process, where at times we're proud and at other times we're embarrassed that decisions betray the ideals of this democracy. And again, we just got to keep fighting. We've always had to fight, and we have to keep fighting today.
That's Michael Curry, head of the Massachusetts League of Community Health Centers, former president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors, and Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR legal analyst. Thanks so much to both of you guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.